When I was a top cadet in the Navy ROTC program, it was guaranteed the Navy scholarship. Not having a Social Security meant that I could not get it.
My brother was 2, my sister was 7, and I was 10. I was in charge of taking care of them, taking care of the house. I became very independent.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. Happy New Year.
Happy 2020.
2020. Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream is our first podcast for 2020. Two tales of young women searching for hope in America.
Before we get started, I want to say you are Jessica Henkin and I am Laura Wexler.
That is absolutely true.
It's still true, even in 2020.
Yep.
We are who we are.
We also want to
be who we be.
Want to thank the Park School of Baltimore, which is still the Park School of Baltimore, an independent, progressive pre-K through grade 12 school located right outside the city.
So this week on the podcast, we're featuring two stories from a show that we did in November with Johns Hopkins Center for Humanitarian Health, which is a group of scholars and activists and scientists and researchers who study migration, internal displacement, forced migrant labor, all sorts of issues around the massive numbers of people moving and searching for safety. This show was presented at the Enoch Pratt Central Library in the beautiful Central Hall. So this first storyteller, Catherine Narvaez, she is a scholar. She is a Somers scholar. So that's someone who received a pretty elite scholarship to get her Master's of Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And at the time she shared this story, DACA was very much in the news, and I think what's so wonderful is we really get a look at what these kind of abstract issues mean in the lived experience of one really articulate, really wonderful young woman.
By the time I was 6 years old, I had experienced a lot of the things that a lot of six-year-old little girls should have experienced. Physical, mental, sexual abuse, poverty, lack of food, nutrition. And at that time, my mother, a single mother of 3 and 8 domestic violence survivor, looked in the eyes of a 6-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 14-year-old, and told us if it was better to migrate to America or to stay at home and continue living these circumstances. At that time, America became hope. And my mother decided that that was the best thing for us. We moved to the capital city where, because of lack of resources and funding or money, there were times where my brother and I would share an egg and my oldest brother and my mom would go to bed hungry. Without any money, we left Guatemala and it took us 1.5 years to get to the United States. We went from town to town, from church to church, asking for shelter, for refuge, for food. And at 6 years old, I realized just how amazing people are. People would open their doors to us, would take their kids off of their bed and offer it to my brothers and I. And they would give us food and they would themselves walk us to the next town. At this time, I wasn't getting educated. I was learning survival skills from my mom. My oldest brother at the age of 14 started working to help my mother financially. When we got to the border, we completely ran out of money. They were charging us $3,000 per person to cross. Obviously, we didn't have that money. Luckily, we went to a church and one of the ladies told us that her son could help us pass. So when I was 7.5, I walked through the desert, through a little forest, and swam across the river to what I thought would be hope. And that couldn't have been furthest from the truth. The first thing that we did when we crossed over was walk to a home because we were starving. We had walked for a long time, and to me, it was an adventure. I was like, this is cool. Like, I'm walking through the desert. Why are we sleeping during the day? Why are we only walking at night? And it didn't really dawn on me the danger that I was in. When we walked to this house, the person was eating church chicken. I don't know if you guys know what church's chicken is. And he literally looked at us, threw the box of chicken on the ground, and told us to leave. And that was my first encounter with an American. Something completely different than what I was accustomed to all through Mexico. We made it to Brownsville, Texas, and my brother, who was 15 and a half at that time, and my mom started working at a fish factory taking the heads off of shrimps. And it took them 3 months to raise enough money so that we could buy tickets from Brownsville to Atlanta, Georgia. We were caught on the way from Brownsville to Houston, and that way we were going to go to Atlanta. So I was in detention center with my family. At that time, we had the catch and release. So my mom was let go, and we made it to Atlanta. Unfortunately, that meant that we had to go to court and all these things, processes that my mom didn't understand, didn't even speak the language. And by the time I was 10, the United States said that we could not seek refuge in America, and we were deported. Unfortunately, that meant that my mom had no choice. She left my sibling and I in the care of friends, while her and my oldest brother went back to Guatemala and took that journey again. So I was left behind with my brother, trying to fend for ourselves. When my mother came back, the same things persisted. I saw my mother work 3 jobs to make ends meet. We prayed endlessly every time we got in a car, hoping that no cop would stop us. Healthcare, education, our housing was a luxury that sometimes we could not afford. Nevertheless, my family's sacrifice had enabled me to really excel academically as an athlete and as a leader. And I was granted a full ride scholarship to go to college. When I was going through the college application process, Georgia did not want me to better myself. I wanted to stay home. I wanted to stay close to my family. Unfortunately, Georgia is very backwards. We're going backwards. And they don't accept undocumented students in their public universities. And even calling admissions counselors if I could apply, and they would tell me, you should go to community college because that's where people like you go. And here I was, a top athlete, graduated in the top percent of my class, leading all these organizations and seeing my peers go to top universities. Why couldn't I? I have been in America since I was 8 years old. Why wasn't I afforded the same opportunities? When I was a top cadet in the Navy ROTC program, it was guaranteed the Navy scholarship. Not having a Social Security meant that I could not get it. After I spent 4 years harvesting a dream of serving this country and going to college and bettering myself, I had to let that boat go. Went to college, wanted to do research, couldn't get the funding because of NIH guidelines. You have to have legal status. Wanted to go to med school, got accepted. Couldn't take out a loan to pay for medical school. When Trump was elected into office, I was living in California at this time. I feared for my family's safety. And that fear came alive when my stepfather was caught driving without a license and was put in detention center. This was October of 2017. Through almost a year and a half, we heard him call us and tell us, it's my time, it's my turn to sleep next to the toilet. They haven't fed us yet. Somebody in our cell is really sick and they're not seeing him. Paying endlessly, a lot of money just to have a conversation with my father. He was deported last year in September. And that took a toll, not only financially, but emotionally on my family. Sometimes I wonder, how did I get lucky that I'm at Johns Hopkins University? Why me? There's a lot of good people on this earth, in the United States, who live in the shadows. I was granted an opportunity to come out through the DACA program. Or even though I don't have a status, I have protection from deportation. How is it that I got lucky, but my brothers didn't? How is it that we use people's decency and humanity as a leveraging tool to advance a discriminatory agenda? It's more than numbers. It's more than trying to seek refuge. We are humans too. And a lot of the times we forget that. When I was 6 years old, I looked and I thought America was hope. And for the past almost 18 years, I have had to fight to belong. All I know is American history. All I know, if you ask me when the civil rights movement started, I will be able to tell you. When women got granted suffrage, I can tell you. This has been my home for majority of my life. And I think it's important that we understand that migration is not a crime. Seeking a better life is not a crime. Wanting something better for your future generations and your family is not a crime. My mother is not a criminal for wanting something better for me. And I don't want to be used to advance a political agenda at an expense of the mother who gave me wings to fly. So, moving forward, I ask that you really pay attention, that when bills come around, that you advocate, that you call your representative, that you educate those around you, create safe spaces for immigrants. Because it's not easy being in a country when you have been vilified, where your entire life or your whole livelihood, you have been considered a criminal. America has watered me. It has fed me. It has allowed me to grow. I am at Johns Hopkins University, one of the best universities in the world. And it was because my mother made that decision for us almost 2 decades ago to migrate us to the United States. It is their sacrifice that have enabled me to get here. My safety and my comfort should not come at the expense of the person who gave me life. My safety and my comfort should not come at the expense of 11 million people who didn't have the opportunity that I have to stand in front of you today to share my story. It's me, only me up here, but it's 11 million people that you probably will never meet, but will thank you when you advocate for them. Thank you.
So she, at the time that she told the story, was working very, very hard to get anyone from Hopkins to support the issue of the Dreamers. And she was very articulate in explaining how complicated that is, how complicated it is in the country for an institution to go on the record and what the ramifications are. Yeah. But she is such an asset to that movement because she is so powerful and so intelligent and so passionate and unrelenting.
Yeah, and this idea that there is hope across the border, that was the idea and the faith that sustained her family and that, you know, had them just walking and traveling millions of miles. And then you get here and you work hard and you have a Naval ROTC scholarship and you can't get it because mm-hmm. you don't have a social. And you can't get a loan to pay for med school, even though you can get into med school. And just the complete disparity of what the American dream meant to her and so many people and what the reality is. It's just so striking. Before we get to our next story on the theme, some dreamers of the golden dream, which is actually a reference to Joan Didion, we want to thank Baltimore Magazine at baltimoremagazine.com. And you can check out their podcast called Local Flavor Live, which is a food scene podcast. And we also want to thank Golden West, which is located on the Avenue in Hamden, is a great spot for vegan food, late night dining, bar events, all sorts of cool things. So this next storyteller, Monica Guerrero Vasquez, there's me with my Spanish, which I love Spanish and I need more practice, but I'm going to just try her middle name again. Guerrero.
Oh, beautiful.
There we go.
Very nice.
Go.
She's the executive director of Centro.
Oh, my God.
Centro.
No.
I took French.
Oh, girl. Executive director of Centro Sol.
Centro
Sol. Which is a advocacy group for immigrants here in Baltimore. And Monica is from Ecuador, and she is sharing a story about, again, it's a story like Catherine's that is at once unique and also stands in for the stories of so many people. Take a listen.
So I think it was a weekday, and I think it was Wednesday, the day that my dad had to leave. He put us in bed. He gave us a kiss. He smiled, and he said, "I love you, and I'll be back soon." At that time, Ecuador was going through a huge economic crisis, and my parents lost everything, including hope. After several months of seeing my mom struggling, of not being able to get food for us, she will be able to bake bread and get some spinach and rice, and we will eat that for weeks, because we had a huge debt. So my parents decided that my mom had to leave too. So the process was similar. She put us in bed one night. She gave us a kiss and her blessings. And she said, "I love you, and I'll be back soon." I was devastated when she left, because I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know when I would see my parents. I didn't know what soon meant. So they trained me to take care of my siblings. My brother was 2, my sister was 7, and I was 10. I was in charge of taking care of them, taking care of the house, paying the debts. I became very independent. I will get groceries, and I will try to emulate everything my parents did for us. So waking up early, taking my sister to school, go to school, and all the other things. At some point, I decided that I had to drop out of school. I missed my parents so much, and I couldn't handle everything that they were doing and they did for us. So with more time to take care of my sister and take her to school and take care of my brother, I decided that I had everything under control. I was a grown-up. My parents will be proud and happy to see me that I was able to handle everything they left for me. But at some point, they decided that they wanted to take us with them. They saved some money and they said, "We will be able to get tickets and bring you with us." I didn't really want to go. See, I wanted to see my parents, but I wanted them to come back as they promised. When we arrived to Spain, my brother cried because he didn't recognize my dad. I was 11. And I thought, see, I was right. Coming here was not a good idea. I didn't know where I was going. Everything I knew was in Ecuador. And now I was in this place that I don't know what it had. Things in Spain didn't get easier for us, or for me. My parents were what I call the mothering slaves, so working 24/7. My mom was a housemaid, and she will spend 6 days a week with this family that she was taking care of, and we will see her once a week, the happiest day of the week. And my dad wasn't allowed to leave his job for any reason. So we lived in an industrial area, no neighbors, no parks, no friends. And I would wake up super early to get my siblings ready and go to take the bus to go to school. And then I would drop them off in school, and then I'd go to my school and I'd pick them up and I'd come back home. The commute was long. But what I remember then was that I will wait for the bus, and sometimes there were cars pulling next to me, and the man from the car will ask, "How much do you charge?" And I will get so angry and so scared. So I will look down and just think, I'll go to college, I will find a good job, and I will leave. Nobody wants us here anyway. And I will pray that the bus will come fast, and that these guys will just leave us alone, and that my siblings and I will be safe. In the back of my head, I just thought, college is going to be freedom. And my mom will tell me, education for a woman is freedom, so that's the only option you have. I don't know how I did it, but I graduated from high school with honors, and I got a scholarship to go to college. I didn't had a lot of mentorship in terms of what I love and what I'm good at, but I was in college. And when I was there, I got selected from a pool of thousands of applicants from all over the world to be an expert on mission with the United Nations. Of all the countries that they could have sent me, they sent me to Ecuador, to the Andean region. I am from the Andean region. They didn't send me to my town, but it didn't matter. I went to the mountains, and after a decade of being in Spain, I finally was in college, and I was going back to my country. And I was so happy. I went back to my roots. My accent came back quickly. I went back home. But my happiness lasted short. I was working for the mayor's office, and this girl came to me, and she said, can you help me set up my weekly call with my parents? I said, sure. How long have your parents been gone? She looked at me very sad, and she said, I don't really know them. They left when I was 3. And that felt like a punch here. And all my memories of all the things that we went through came back. That moment changed my life. I wasn't the expert on mission anymore. I thought, what can I do to change this? I'm not ready. I'm not ready. But I want to change this. I want the kids to be happy. Kids should not be without their parents. So when I finished my mission, I went back to Spain, and I applied for a master's program. And I was accepted. But I promised my parents that when I graduated from college, I will work and help them. I had 3 part-time jobs while I was doing my master's, but my parents stopped working 24/7, so we had dinner all together every night. And when I graduated from the master's, I found a decent job, as my mom promised, and on the side, I will work with immigrant parents to help them use technology to connect with their kids back home. And I started doing international cooperation with indigenous communities in Latin America. But economic crisis hit my life again, and in 2011, I made my way to Baltimore. Baltimore became like a home for me. I found people who looked like me, who spoke like me, and who were going through the same struggles that we went through. And I'm so grateful that life brought me here. I feel that I found a place where I fit, where I'm accepted for how I look, because I've never been white enough or belong enough. Here, I'm blessed to serve moms and dads who look like mine. And most strongly, I work with kids who remind me and my siblings. See, my work here became like an extension of my life. I found a sense of purpose, that my skills finally were tools to help others, to relieve their pain and their struggle and their loneliness. And I'm so fortunate and so happy that my dreams came true. Sometimes I daydream that I go back in time and I talk to little 10-year-old Monica. And I tell her, Monica, it's okay to feel lonely. It's okay to be sad and depressed and abandoned. It's okay to feel that nobody loves you and nobody accepts you and that you're different and that you're different is bad. I would love to comfort her and say, Monica, you will make it to college and you will help other kids like you. I'm sure she will be so happy. Thank you.
So one of the most powerful moments of her story is when she is going back and talking to her child self and telling her, you know, it's going to be okay. You're going to get through this.
I also was so moved by the way in which her parents told her and her siblings the very difficult news that they were leaving, that they tucked them in bed. And it was almost as if, like, that was the best possible way to deliver the worst possible news,
yeah.
Right? That they got their kids into a place where they were safe and warm and ready to, you know, slumber. And then I just think as a parent, like, where's the part of the day that's best suited to tell your kids you're leaving and you're leaving the entire family in charge, in the care of a 10-year-old girl? Like, it's just... That was really, really moving.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening to a heavier episode of the podcast. We want to thank The Wine Source, which is a great place to go to...
Lighten your mood.
Lighten your mood, get through the day, get through the evening, or just bring a nice bottle of wine to a friend's house to chat about what's going on in the world. They are located on Elm Avenue in Baltimore. We also want to share news of a January Stoop event. We have an upcoming Stoop show at the Auto Bar in Baltimore, which is a great venue for music and comedy and now storytelling. A Beautiful Terrible Thing, Making a Life in Independent Music. You can come out and share your story about being in a band, loving indie music, whatever it is.
Working in record stores.
Yep.
What day is that?
That is January 23rd at the Auto Bar in Baltimore.
You can find out more about that show at stoopstorytelling.com. You can also find our podcast wherever you get podcast content, and leave us a review would be great. Thank you to Maureen Harvey for producing the podcast, and we will see you back next week.